This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A little bit later, we'll look at the end of the Galileo mission to Jupiter. But first, the phrase reinventing the wheel isn't usually a compliment. But in nanotechnology, the science of working with structures and devices on an ultra-small scale, figuring out how to make a tiny working wheel is considered a big deal. Or take building an abacus, the ancient calculator device with, you know, those sliding beads on it. Doesn't seem like much of a feat until you do it using beads that are just single molecules. Researchers are still learning how to work with materials at such a small scale, where some of the behaviors of materials we take for granted, well, they just don't apply in the world of the ultra-tiny. But the techniques and tools are coming into place, and that excites some people and concerns others. Some see a nanotechnology future as empowering, a future foretold in Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age. Others see it as offering new dangers, tiny machines that might get out of control, a future seen in Michael Crichton's Prey. It's an issue so big that while the government is funding plenty of research into the nuts and bolts of nanotech, the National Science Foundation also gave out two major grants looking at the ethical issues and nanotech's possible effects on society. Well, we're going to be talking about nanotechnology and the future of it this hour. We'll get into the ethical issues. So give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Ralph Merkel is the Vice President for Technology Assessment at the Foresight Institute, a group that thinks a lot about nanotechnology. He's a professor at Georgia Tech College of Computing and Georgia Institute of Technology, based in Atlanta. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. James Jimczewski is a professor of chemistry at the University of California, Los Angeles, in L.A. Welcome back to the program. James, how are you? Oh, I guess we're having trouble hearing him. Let me ask you first. I got to tell you something, Ralph. Before I did this program this week, I have to keep a promise I made earlier. I met an acquaintance who knew we were going to be talking about nanotechnology, and she very much wanted to listen to the hour because she had heard a lot about it. But not, being a non-scientist, her husband is a scientist, she was afraid this topic was way over her head. And if I was going to do this topic, I had to find a way to ask the simple questions so that she could understand just what nanotechnology is. Ralph, can you help us there? Explain
sure.
In simple language what it is?
Well, let's start out with just the size scale.
Okay.
Nanotechnology is about things that are very small, and it's really, really small. So your arm is about 1 meter in length. 1,000 times smaller than that is a millimeter. 1,000 times smaller than that is a micron. 1,000 times smaller than that, 1 billion times smaller than your arm, is a nanometer. And atoms, those little building blocks of matter, sort of like nature's Lego set, are a little bit smaller than a nanometer. So we're going to be talking about arranging atoms, the fundamental building blocks of matter, and it makes a big difference how the atoms are arranged.
And what things can you do with these atoms that you're arranging?
Well, think of it this way. I mean, coal is the same as diamond, except the atoms are arranged differently. Sand has the same atoms, if you add a pinch of impurities, as computer chips. And, of course, the difference between good health and bad health is, again, how the atoms are arranged. So in the coming decades, nanotechnology is going to let us inexpensively arrange atoms in most of the ways permitted by physical law. And I'm sure you're wondering, what exactly does that mean? Well, first off, we're going to continue to make more powerful and smaller computers. Molecular computers are coming. We haven't seen the end of the computer hardware revolution, not by a long shot. These computers, these molecular computers, are going to be so powerful that in the future we'll be able to pack as much computational power in the volume of a sugar cube as exists in the entire world today. That's a lot of computer power.
When you say about arranging atoms, single atoms, is that not what our body does when we're born and we're growing? Isn't that like the definition of what life is, so to speak? It's arranging these things?
Well, everyone arranges that. Whenever you do manufacturing, you arrange atoms. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you're making steel, you're arranging atoms. Now, admittedly, it's very crude. You're pouring large numbers of atoms into these large molds that get them sort of roughly in the right place. But it is arranging atoms. And as our manufacturing technology has gotten finer and finer, as the decades have gone by, we've gotten better and better. And of course, biology does arrange atoms and molecules very precisely. Biology shows us that molecular machines are possible. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of people point to biology as the existence proof, saying, we know molecular machines are possible. Just as people in the 1800s would point at birds and say, heavier than air flight is possible because we can see birds. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a big difference between biology and, well, you can imagine a 747. A 747 is a lot different from a sparrow. Really very different things. Yeah. And that's because when we build things differently.
Yeah. Jim Zeski, a few years ago you were with us talking about your molecular scale abacus. Have you gotten there? Where has that field gone since then?
Well,
have you gotten up to the PlayStation size of these things, or are you still in the abacus size?
No, we are still more. I mean, that experiment was really to demonstrate how, you know, under conditions just like room temperature, how we could do something on the molecular scale. And that was basically a very small step to shift these 10 buckyball molecules that were around about 1 nanometer in diameter across a step and count from 0 to 10. And it wasn't meant to really imply, now we're going to have, you know, a bigger abacus or, you know, whatever. It was a demonstration, and it was something that I enjoyed very much, and it inspired a lot of people. The directions we go in now are to understand and control complexity on a larger scale more and more, you know, in the molecular world. And that was just, you know, the first simple demonstration, and it was something that, you know, people didn't imagine you could do.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned before that, you know, if you reinvent the wheel, it's sort of a derogatory, but not in nanotechnology, right?
No. So one of the other things we did was to find a molecule which actually looked a little bit like a propeller, and we found that under the right conditions we could have this molecule rotate like a wheel, a molecular wheel. It was the first observation of such a thing. And the amazing thing was that it was just driven by the temperature of the room. It would turn around. And the other kind of fascinating things about it was that, you know, the conventional concept of friction that operate on normal wheels doesn't really apply when something is so small and so, you know, just constructed atoms on a very small scale.
So what could you do with your mechanical nanotechnologies?
Well, you know, at this moment in time, if you take some practical example of what you can do, I would say very little, except perhaps inspire people and understand more and more about complexity. There is a certain view in the field of nanotechnology that a kind of mechanistic evolution of mechanics will appear again. You know, we had the Industrial Revolution, which was really the ability to control the tolerances of mechanical things like wheels, and that enabled the Industrial Revolution. The Information Technology Revolution was about controlling electricity and more or less electrons. And so people foresee on the molecular scale this kind of resurgence of a new type of Industrial Revolution driven by mechanics. I believe that is somewhat an oversimplification, but it's certainly extremely interesting to note that the mechanical properties of very small systems are really attractive. They involve very little energy, so ecologically they're sound. They're also very small and many of the concepts such as friction, you know, and wear, which accounts for maybe, I don't know, some 10% of the energy used in the United States, is, you think we could make things that would be not frictionless, but would have a different type of friction.
Let me ask both of you, because these are such small-scale objects, are they going to be limited to doing very small-scale jobs? How do they fit in?
Well, I think the answer to that question is no, they won't be limited. I think just because something is small doesn't mean you can't have a lot of them. Massive parallelism lets you build large numbers of things. Certainly you can look at the mighty oak, and when you realize the mighty oak is built out of very small cells, you have to conclude, yes, it's possible to build large things starting from very small things.
So you like assemble things from them?
Yeah, you can arrange things. Basically, once you have the basic building blocks, and I have to confess, I'm very impressed with James' works. His work experimentally is wonderful, and also I'd like to emphasize the importance of this kind of work, because if we're going to be able to arrange atoms on a small scale, there's a lot of experimental work that has to be done, and I think people have to realize this and support that work. I think support for this kind of effort is very important, and as we go on, as we start arranging things, we're going to start out small, because pretty obviously we're going to arrange small numbers of atoms, small number of molecules at a time. And then I think as time goes by, we'll start working up, we'll start using parallelism, we'll start doing a lot of things at once, and we will be able to build things. We'll be able to build computers. Computers with billions, trillions, gazillions, if I can use that term, large numbers of switches in them, that really are going to be quite powerful. So I think we're looking at a long-term future, and I should emphasize it's going to take a while to get there, where we really will be able to build a wide range of things.
Do the atoms and the molecules themselves do the building? I mean, do we just say, get it going, and it starts, you watch it grow almost as if it were a living device?
Well, I should say there are two kinds of sort of manufacturing. One is self-assembly, where the atoms and the molecules do arrange themselves. You pour them into a test tube and stir, and if you've been clever about how you've done things, they form what you want. So that's one approach to arranging atoms. It's very powerful. People have been doing research in it for, well, centuries now, if you look back at the history of chemistry. And another approach is sort of the hands-on approach. In this approach, we take our cue from our hands. We can hold parts, we can position parts, we can assemble them. And if we can scale that concept down to the molecular size, if we can position individual atoms and molecules and assemble them, then we have a very powerful ability, a very flexible ability to manufacture things with molecular precision. And I think that's going to have a very big impact in the future.
But we're not close to being able to do that yet.
Well, I don't know. I'll let Jim talk about, you know, how close we are on the experimental front. We can do it somewhat.
Yeah. You know, I think that if it depends on how complex a function you want. But if you take, for instance, the hard disk drive in your computer, on at least a high-end disk, you're going to have one single layer of molecules, okay? And that one single layer of molecules is protecting that hard disk. And you imagine imagine something flying above that, a distance that's maybe 10 or 20 molecules, and you imagine that that head is flying from a distance which is the equivalent from here to the moon and back in a year. And that molecule is designed to have that very special function, which is essential for the operation of the device. Now, of course, it's a simple application.
Well, let me let you hold that thought. So we have to take a simple break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about nanotechnology with Jim Zeski and Ralph Merkel. When I interrupted rudely, Jim, he was telling us about... Give us actually a proportion in size with the kinds of things he was talking about. The hard drive of a disk drive in a computer. Tell us.
Yeah, an advanced one.
An advanced one.
So, you know, in that case, you have, a head flying above a spinning surface, okay? and you're talking about, you know, molecular dimensions, that head is flying above the surface. You have a layer, it's called monolayer lubricant. You have one just single layer of molecules, and it's protecting it. And the distance that that thing is flying, that head, you know, is something like the distance from here to the moon and back.
Wow.
In a year. So these are they're very simple examples of how nanotechnology has been used today. You know, other things are like you've heard of nanopants, you know. It's a kind of coating on trousers, tiny little nanofibers, so you can throw Coca-Cola and hamburgers on your trousers and, you know, basically wipe it off and they don't stain. There's all sorts of things like that that revolve around the use of coatings or powders, but they're more or less an evolution, an intelligent evolution of existing technologies.
Mm-hmm. There's also some remarkable things in terms of the millipede, I think, IBM's effort to have a massive array, thousands or more, of scanning probe microscopes and using them all at once to write simultaneously. It's though you had a bundle of 1,000 pens and you could write 1,000 different things all at the same time. And that, again, is an application of very high-density memory, making very small marks on a surface.
Let me bring in another guest, David Baird. He's professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy, University of South Carolina, member of that institute's Nano Center. He's also the principal investigator on a new grant from the National Science Foundation called From Laboratory to Society, Developing an Informed Approach to Nanoscale Science and Technology. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Professor, tell us, what is wrong with all these? What is the ethical problems that you're looking into and that the NSF is concerned about?
I think I wouldn't say problems so much as ethical impacts. It's pretty clear from what's been said so far and other things that the technology that's coming out of nanotechnology can have a very profound impact on all kinds of dimensions of human life and society, and we're here to try to initiate an examination of that and to do so in an interdisciplinary way with the scientists and engineers, but also with humanists, social scientists, and artists.
Davis, give us an idea of what those concerns are.
Well, I think right at the outset you need to make a distinction between kinds of nanotechnology you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So you might talk about plain vanilla nanotechnology. This would be new materials. These are things that we have now, new catalysts, new functionalities. Much more interesting, radical molecular manufacturing. This has been discussed. Here we have radically new ways of manufacturing materials by sort of manipulating atoms. And then there's another area which is where there's a lot of research going, which is not specifically nano, although I think nano is leading this, and that's in the area of human enhancement, where new ways of integrating artifice, things we make, into human beings are being developed. And
like artificial eyes and limbs and things like that?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so each of these you have to think about somewhat differently in terms of impacts, and similarly you have to think about impacts differently in terms of time frames, either here and now, medium term, long term. I mean, here and now there are new nanoparticles on the market. A question is, are they toxic? There are watchdog groups that have called for moratoria. I don't think that's a good idea myself, but I think it does raise the question. We have to look at the toxicity. We have to look at how they're regulated.
Can you give us an idea what kind of particles you're talking about?
Well, carbon nanotubes are the ones that actually have been discussed in the literature. Although, frankly, the evidence here is lacking. I mean, that's perhaps part of the problem, is that we're just beginning to start to do work on toxicity studies for both at the human and environmental level.
Because the thought is if we start putting these things in people, we haven't done the tests on how they might react to these things.
And there's a regulatory issue here because, for example, I mean, you can buy sunscreen with nano-sized particles in it, and you make it that way because they're no longer white and goopy. They're clear, so it's a nicer cosmetic sunscreen. That's available. What we don't know is, do those particles, how are they ingested transdermally, and do they cause problems? There's no evidence that they do. But the fact that we have a chemical that's judged safe in general, there's a regulatory question, is judging safe in general, does it apply to the nanoscale? Because properties clearly change when you have particles at the nanoscale, among other things, whether or not it's white and goopy or clear.
So this is why now a lot of money is being invested in understanding these problems and thinking about them. Is that because we are now at a ripe age where these things will be coming more and more into society?
I'd like to think that part of the push here is an outgrowth of the very sort of notion of nanotechnology, which is a fundamentally interdisciplinary area, bringing physicists, chemists, engineers, biologists together. And I think part of the idea is people in the funding agencies realize that, well, technology doesn't stop with the artifact. Mm-hmm. The artifact is integrated into society itself, and we need to think about those integrations. That has to be part of the process of pursuing these artifacts, is thinking about their societal integration and implications.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Tom in Los Gatos, California. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Fascinating program. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I live here in Silicon Valley, and the main fallout, besides lots of money for the computer industry here, is pollution. I've heard that every component in the modern computer is toxic. In fact, we have, we send our computers over to India and places like that to get recycled because they are so toxic. So I'm really worried about pollution, you know, whether nano or whatever, anything associated with the high-tech factor, you know, of course, bacteria and viruses and everything else. But how are we going to limit the, you know, when they become self-replicating, like was mentioned earlier, how do we put a stop to it? Is, you know, like oak trees, the mighty oaks, when they get to a certain height, they automatically stop growing, and people and animals, they have, you know, built-in regulators to keep them from getting too big, and unless they have a, you know, a thyroid problem or something like that. So, I mean, we're going to have, you know, artificial eyes carpeting the ground, you know, like that sunscreen, or like, you know, like in a Man Ray movie. You know, Star Trek, you know, there's been a lot of programs on that, but that's one of the main, you know, science fiction things that comes up is, you know, the old Frankenstein,
right.
You know, story.
Right, that was Michael Crichton's Prey, basically. He talks about that
right.
In his book.
So I'm glad you asked about the pollution issue, because obviously if you have a technology that doesn't have control over where the atoms go, what I'd call actually a low-tech manufacturing technology, then oftentimes you wind up with arrangements of atoms, you don't know what to do with them, and up the smokestack they go. If you actually have a precise manufacturing technology, a technology that does give you control over molecular structure and molecular arrangements, you don't make pollutants. You don't make it because there's no need to make it. You have precise control. If there is an excess of sulfur, you might produce sulfur bricks and sell them on the sulfur market.
Would it help global warming? Would it have anything to do with global warming?
Well, if you consider coal burning, okay, and it's a very inefficient way to generate energy, or oil burning, coal burning, the increase in background radioactivity is dominated by coal burning, not by, you know, atomic reactors, for instance.
That's
if you
right.
consider these particles, you know, like nanotubes and buckyballs,
yeah,
burning
carbon.
Coal probably generates more of them in the atmosphere than anything else. So one of my dreams for nanotechnology is that it can be used to actually reduce pollution and find efficient ways, even in existing manufacturing technologies, to stop this, you know, terrible ecological disaster we're headed towards if we don't actually change, you know, our manufacturing techniques and use nanotechnology, not necessarily self-replicating nanobots, but just very clever tricks and twists to increase the efficiency energy-wise and reduce the emissions. And so in that respect, I'm very positive about the impact that nanotechnology can have on our society.
Tom, thanks for calling.
Solar power is something which can potentially provide all the power we need and many orders of magnitude more. We haven't done it because solar power cells just cost too much economically. It hasn't quite made the cut yet. if we have a manufacturing technology that can manufacture these solar cells inexpensively and in large volumes, then we can shift over from a society where we dig holes in the ground to get coal and oil and nuclear fuels to a society that absorbs sunshine and uses that to power all of our society.
Well, let's go with that idea a little bit. How would nanotechnology create those solar cells more efficiently and, you know, less expensively?
I mean, isn't there even a prior to assemblers just increasing the, through better use of catalysts, increasing the efficiency of the solar cells, which seems more likely to happen in the nearer term than to assemblers?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's definitely the evolutionary advances going on in solar cells are very impressive and can be watched. And I think also as time goes by, eventually we do in the longer term and the sort of the decade or multi-decade time frame get really dramatic decreases in manufacturing costs. So there's no reason in principle that manufacturing costs can't be made very low, certainly. A number of biological products, whether it be oak trees or wood or wheat or corn, demonstrate that manufacturing costs on the order of $1 a pound are entirely feasible.
Well, I'm going to keep repeating this till I can understand it, unless some of my listeners can understand it. But how would nanotechnology allow you to bring those costs and make those solar cells cheaper?
Well, I can give you one example.
Okay, good.
Is the concept of direct manufacture. The way we make things at the moment is, you know, chemists, the chemical industry, they make massive amounts of stuff. The steel industry make big lumps of steel. And what do we do with them then? We take them, we grind them, we cut them, we weld them, screw them together. You look at the construction, you know, something like an F-15 aircraft, it's full of studs. There's an assembly line 2 miles long. They're putting all this stuff together. All this stuff is getting wasted and cut and remelted down, more pollution and so on. Now consider the control of matter in such a way you can put the atoms where they want. And this doesn't need to be something out of Michael Crichton book. Just imagine a robotic device. And I know, you know, a certain aircraft company that are doing research on this, a robotic device which can then deposit atoms where you want. It could be a very slow process, but then you could directly, if you like, spin the wing of an aircraft, okay, by moving the robotic arm around and depositing the material. Now, what we have a situation is where we completely are reducing the waste. Now, similarly with solar cells, as we can control things on a much precise level, put the matter where we want and don't waste, you know, stuff. That's the problem with the pollution up in Silicon Valley, all this stuff, effluent, ancient stuff that go into the atmosphere and so on. We can eliminate that step. This direct manufacture is one direction we can go. The other direction is computer theories getting better and better to precisely tune the molecular properties, say, of the solar cell, and at the same time, our ability to control the precision of depositing that. That doesn't mean more money. Mm-hmm. In terms of the cost of manufacture. It means less money, and it means less waste and less pollution. And that is the kind of general direction I see things going. I don't see swarms of nanobots, you know, buzzing outside the window here at UCLA necessarily, but it makes a good story that people enjoy. The problem is that people read that one book, they're not given enough information from what is really going on in nanotech, and then the fear factor strikes and they all believe, you know, it's swarms of nanobots.
I couldn't agree more, but I'd like to say one thing about the solar thing, which is simply, here's an example where a new technology potentially has huge implications for workforce, because we have a very large workforce centered around coal and oil.
Oh, yeah.
So it's one area where it would be a good thing, in my view, but you have to think about how that's going to impact large social structures which are built around a different kind of technology.
Talking about nanotechnology this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. How close are we to getting useful devices yet, gentlemen, on you know, just taking it out of the laboratory and into the...
Well, it depends very much on your definition of a useful device, I think, as Jim pointed out. There are things out there today that are useful, and we're talking about nanotechnology available in products right now. On the other hand, if you're looking at the sort of the more dramatic capabilities that people talk about, those are likely to be a few decades. So, for example, medical devices, disease and ill health, they're caused by damage, largely caused by damage at the molecular and cellular level. And if we had molecular medical devices that could intervene at that level, we could have really dramatic advances in medicine. I don't think that's going to happen tomorrow. I think that's, you know, a decade or two or three away. But pretty clearly it's in the pipeline, and I think we're going to get that kind of technology.
So you'd have these micro mini devices that instead of acting as a drug, they would act mechanically to interfere with the process of disease?
They could indeed. I mean, there are a lot of examples. I think one of the simplest examples is simply artificial red blood cells, which would be little more than a little scuba tank filled with compressed oxygen. And these devices would be smaller than an ordinary red blood cell. They haven't been built. This is a theoretical discussion, but they look eminently feasible. Such devices, if injected into the human body, could then provide oxygen to the tissues, just as your normal red blood cells do. The big difference is they could hold a lot more oxygen. So they could hold over 100 times as much oxygen, which means you could hold your breath for over an hour, or more dramatically, if you had a heart attack and had been prophylactically injected with these devices, you'd have an hour's time in which to get to the emergency room and have the doctors check you out and find out what caused the heart attack and take care of it.
Wow. Well, we have to take a break, and thank you all for joining us this hour. This is certainly an ongoing topic. We're going to be picking it up as this technology matures. Ralph Merkel is the Vice President for Technology Assessment at the Foresight Institute, Professor at Georgia Tech College of Computing at Georgia Institute of Technology. James Jimczewski is Professor of Chemistry at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Davis Byrd is Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of South Carolina. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
We're going to take a short break and switch gears, and when we come back, we're going to talk about saying farewell to the Galileo space probe as it lost, I guess, its life, you could say, over this weekend as it plunged into the planet Jupiter. We'll look back and see why it was such an important mission and how successful it was. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, from NPR News.